Choose life. Choose a job. Choose a career. Choose a brand of coffee. Choose freshly roasted beans, front door delivery, regular or decaf. Choose your blend. Choose your roast. Choose the ethical brand. Choose to make better coffee at home than you can buy in the cafe. Choose Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug Coffee uses only premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including a rotating blend for those of you addicted to novelty, and decaf and half-caf for those of you kicking the habit. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug even offers autopilot set-it-and-forget-it deliveries so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. And the reason? There's no reason. Who needs a reason when you've got coffee?
Oh, that's the stuff.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Happy December, movie monsters, and thanks for pressing play on the next 100 Project, the every Monday podcast that spends some time looking back at old classics. In this case, not so old. If us spoiling said classics makes you feel like injecting heroin into your veins, then stop listening. I'm the very unscottish Ryan Ellis, and here's my dog-spotting wife, Bev.
That's me.
I see two dogs. Do you see two dogs? You do, don't you?
Yeah.
Okay, the coming attraction trivia for this week's picture, Trainspotting. Not counting Trainspotting 2, which comes out in a few months. Who has Danny Boyle worked with the most as a director? The actor Robert Carlyle, the writer John Hodge, the producer Andrew McDonald, or big star Ewan McGregor?
So by hair, I counted Andrew McDonald to be the winner with 7, including the short film Alien Love Triangle.
Oh, I should have said big screen movies, feature films.
But it's okay, it gets canceled out because John Hodge, who comes in 2nd with 6, including Alien Love Triangle.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so they both work on the project, so it cancels it.
So 6 and 5 is what I have for those two guys. Yeah, then McGregor has 3 projects with him, 3 in a row, in fact, because he followed this up with A Life Less Ordinary, and he'd started with Shallow Grave. And then Robert Carlyle, I thought maybe he'd made 3 or 4 or even more pictures with Boyle, but only this and The Beach, although he is one of the stars of 28 Weeks Later, which Boyle executive produced or just produced it. I know that much.
He directed the original 28 Weeks Later.
And was
later,
involved in the sequel.
The sequel, yeah.
That's why I had to make sure we say it as a director. So it's one of those trivia questions I thought, well, we know Ewan McGregor and he had a falling out, so it couldn't have been that many movies that they made together. And all of these people, as far as I understand, will be involved in the sequel. So the next 100 Project's 42nd movie film, Trainspotting, wasn't made in the USA, so it couldn't have been nominated for any AFI Top 100 lists. After being screened at Cannes in 1996, Miramax and Polygram and probably dozens of other production companies released it that summer. Critics said yay, and people everywhere made it an indie hit. But Bev, remind those who are not familiar with Trainspotting with your skinny.
Ewan McGregor is Mark Renton, the leader of a bunch of heroin-addicted youths in late 80s Edinburgh. The film follows their crazy exploits as they get on and off the horse in Thatcher-era Scotland. Oh, and it's often really, really gross.
Thatcher-era Scotland is a part of that is very key. It's never said in the movie that I can recall, but that's a very big, important point because she was not good, probably not Reagan either, in America, for anybody who was not conservative in the 80s. As much as people look back at Reagan and Thatcher as these gods in their countries, they hurt a lot of people.
Listen, the poor in the UK, they hate Thatcher. She was cruel to the poor. And I never knew until I was doing my research for the film that it takes place in the 80s.
Late 80s, yeah.
But the music, the fashion, it looks like a very 90s film, so I found that a little surprising. But in the late 80s, when it takes place, Scotland had record unemployment, and they had a heroin and HIV epidemic.
Which you can't just blame on Thatcher, but the policies of someone like that who doesn't care about people who aren't doing okay already. Get a job! Fuck them if they can't catch up! And then they do things like this, not to excuse their behavior. But let me nutshell this, and I'll include the behavior part in my nutshell. I can't believe these idiots would take such an addictive substance! Now, Bev, go fetch my sugar, my liquor, my caffeine, and my really big bowl of hypocrisy. Well, heroin's worse than all those things, but we should not forget when we talk about drug addicts, those who want to go on about, oh, why can't they kick the habit? Well, because you're not kicking the habit if you're doing sugar and if you're doing caffeine and liquor and other things, which are all legal.
And one of the things that makes Trainspotting special, it doesn't treat the addict like the other. These characters are actually highly relatable. They seem like you and I are people that we might know. they explain the appeal of heroin in the way that other drug addict movies, and there's a lot you could choose from, you can think of. I mean, from the time there was Christian F. or The Man with the Golden Arm.
The Basketball Diaries.
Or
the
Basketball
same time
Diaries
frame.
Was definitely a big one. It was a popular film, but those films are dour. You know, they tell the story from atop a high horse where... High horse, what a great metaphor. Yeah. But they tell the story from the point of view of somebody who would never be caught making the same mistakes as these characters. Whereas there's something about these guys that just seems real. It's like a down-to-earth attic movie.
The movie makes drugs look awful, but also, I think wisely, shows the bliss. Mm-hmm. More than once, we see just how awesome it is to get high, especially on something like heroin. I've never tried it, you've never tried it, but people do it for a reason.
And they're clear about what the alternative is. You know, they're young men, they are looking at bleak prospects. There's a real hopelessness to living in a place like Scotland in Thatcher in the 80s. So, in a manner of speaking, it's like a suicide. It's like giving up and saying, why would I embrace the same boring life? Why would I choose life, as they say in the beginning monologue? A brilliant monologue. It's great to hear, but even to read it, it is on fire. It's
Tyler,
such a great piece of writing.
Tyler Durden-esque.
A little bit,
Fight Club
yes.
Owner, what's his name? Jim Polonek?
Chuck Polonek.
Okay. Jim Yules, anyway.
Yeah.
Getting the names wrong here, but I wonder if that guy was inspired by the book, which was written in 1993. I think Fight Club probably came later. I'm not sure about that. Because Tyler Durden does owe a little debt, maybe, to the same kind of deal going
and
here.
Yeah, they're both really anti-establishment movies about young men who are lost in the system and don't want what they're supposed to want.
And whose voiceovers are a little bit bullshit, too.
Oh, yeah. Ren knows he's full shit. He knows that he's a bad person. He knows that he's fucking it all up, but he's still making that choice.
One thing you said a minute ago about why he does this, he does say, I think it's about midway through the film, when he is completely clean after he's gone hard turkey, he's bored. It's boring to be off heroin after you've been doing it for so long, at least it is for him. And then also when they're doing the work of finding the money to buy the drugs, stealing from people, stealing from retirement home, their television, that's a funny but awful scene, of course. But is that half the reason to be on the H, to give yourself something to do?
It's a whole life. It is taking yourself out of that rat race where you don't feel like you belong and you don't see where it's going. You don't see the point of putting your nose down and behaving yourself. Not just that, you have this kind of built-in family of sorts. Of course, it's a highly, highly dysfunctional family, but there's the camaraderie of addicts. They have these friends, they look after each other, and they share this pursuit, they share this love of just shooting up.
Except for Robert Carlyle, who's the one that doesn't do the drugs at any point in the film. And the other guy, what's his name, Kevin McKidd, doesn't do them for a while. We skipped over the part I usually would have gotten to 5 or 10 minutes ago, which are the numbers. Let's do that quickly. So Rotten Tomatoes numbers, very good. 90% of critics liked the movie, 69 fresh, 8 rotten, and 93% of audiences. It's also 162nd on the IMDb's 250, but then, of course, that is a subjective poll, maybe more than most. I've mentioned it many times, though, because it is a voter poll. Most things we talk about, the average person can't affect, except maybe the box office, but then they can only buy so many tickets to affect that. Trainspotting is 10th on the British Film Institute's 1999, so a little while ago now. Top 100 British films ever. So it only had a few years to make that list. The Third Man, which we covered quite a ways back, was number one. Also, the other David Lean films were on that list. Bridge and River Quiet, Lawrence of Arabia, Dr. Zhivago, and a few others I think we've covered. I'm drawing a blank as to which of those are right now. But
Clockwork Orange,
right? Yeah, because that's
which
really
we'll
an English
about,
film.
About
oh, absolutely.
This film as well.
And Trainspotting was 97th at the 1996 U.S. box office, which isn't bad. It made $16.5 million. They had a fast shoot, and they had a low budget, but they end up making that money back, obviously, in spades. And we talked about, a few times now, we've talked about Weinstein's Miramax in the last few months with Three Colors and with Bad Santa. They were involved with that. Now here they are again and making some money and releasing a picture that people still talk about. The movie is 20 years old. They didn't release the sequel in time for the 20-year anniversary, which was the plan. I don't know why, but it's not coming out until, I think it's January in Scotland, and we'll probably see it a few months later here over in North America.
Did it get any festival releases?
I think the actual release day, because festivals will mess that up.
Yeah.
You'll see sometimes, especially if something went to TIFF first in September and then maybe comes out in March or April or even the middle of the summer of the next year, Crash, the Oscar winner in 2005, actually on the IMDb says 2004. But no, Trainspotting 2 or T2, as it says online, a little copyright infringement going on there, I think, that actually says 2017. The movie's set in Edinburgh, we said that already. It's mostly shot in Glasgow, though, and some of it in London. I guess when Renton goes to London, a lot of that is actually shot there. And I really like a few touches. One of them is when the movie begins, they're already addicts. Renton is trying to quit, but we don't see that whole thing where they first get that buzz of trying heroin. I guess we sort of see it with Tommy's character, and we definitely get the idea of what it was like for Renton the first time, because every time he does heroin, or the other guys too, they have that look on their face, oh, I'm home, which is probably what they looked like the first time they tried it. But the fact is, the movie just starts, they already are addicts, and I like that touch, because so many movies that are about this kind of subject matter would show them just starting. A movie that actually is not about drugs, but makes a person look awfully bad, and we said a few minutes ago about how movies like this usually aren't fun. The year before Leaving Las Vegas, we're seeing Nicolas Cage, who had been an alcoholic probably for many years, and at the end of that run of being an alcoholic. But then that movie is not glamorizing it at all.
Another thing that Trainspotting leaves out, which is refreshing, none of the characters have these dour, sad backstories. We never learn about their childhood abuse or trauma that they experienced
they
that
probably
led
have
them to
those.
Become drug dealers. They might, but it's irrelevant. And I'm happy about that.
Well, they probably have those stories, but we just don't learn about them. Renton seems to be doing okay. His father, James Cosmo, was in another Scottish film you may have heard of the year before, Braveheart. He plays Hamish's father. One thing I noticed when you were doing your sponsor at the top of the podcast was you were too intelligible. This movie is almost a foreign language film. We've covered a few foreign films this year officially, and this maybe technically should be our fourth, or I guess for Three Colors, that was three pictures, but our fourth foreign language podcast. I almost asked you if we could turn the subtitles on.
I have never actually watched a film with subtitles before, but I've been tempted many times. And I thought this time around, I was like, wow, this is even worse than I remember. But it is worse than I remember because there's actually two versions. Initially, the American version that they released that we're all familiar with, they redubbed the first 20 minutes of the film so that it was comprehensible to an American audience. It's not just the accents, which are thick and hard. Mm-hmm. But there's also dialect that
slang.
Is just, yeah, slang is completely unfamiliar to us. It is as though it's a different language. Like you say, it's unintelligible. Scottish English is almost a different dialect of English. I find Scottish people next to impossible to understand without squint my eyes and stare and listen really carefully and slowly. Begbie? 1/3 of what he says is intelligible to me. I think it's because half of the words he's speaking are deep slang that we're not familiar with. It is as though it's in a different language.
Robert Carlyle is playing Begbie. He was in The Full Monty the next year, and it's funny how that was the movie that got him so much more attention. Well, I guess this one did,
too. No, if you look him up on IMDb, Robert Carlyle, known for Trainspotting, that's the touchstone picture that people go to recognize
what
him.
What I mean is that got a mainstream attention, unlike this picture, where he definitely is one of the standouts in the whole picture. I guess along with McGregor.
He needed to have a Full Monty to come out, too, so that he could shake the persona of Begbie, because it is one of the great villains.
That could typecast
he
him forever.
He is such a terrifying psychopath.
I was reading that he plays him as a closeted gay man, so he's always playing the simmering violence of somebody who wants to be with men, but can't be, because back then, maybe even now, in certain parts of the world, you're not allowed to be what you really are, so that's why he's so angry all the time.
And there is that scene where he picks up a transgendered woman and discovers when it's too late she has a penis and freaks out. Mm-hmm. Although, refreshingly, he doesn't attack her. He just kind of humiliates her, but he doesn't get violent with her the way he does with virtually everybody else who crosses his path at some point.
Somebody throws beer on him. Doesn't even throw beer on him. Somebody accidentally knocks his beer into him, completely unintentional. The guy apologizes as much as he can. He starts this brutal fight, cuts him open with his glass, and he slams the glass into him. That's the end of the movie. But
gruesome.
He has a fight early on where he fights him for no reason whatsoever.
He does some guy opening up a bag of chips and distracting him while he's playing pool, and he gets a pool cue cracked over his back. Mm. He just fights people in the bar who are mad at him for throwing the glass over the balcony. He's a scary man, and that tension is really felt every time he's on screen.
I want to go back to the heroin users, because Begbie is not one of those. And in the opening of the movie, when you see Sick Boy and Renton and Allison, the one who has the baby that dies, all doing heroin, they all have that blissful, reaction to the heroin going in. But you don't see the needles going in those heroin scenes. You don't see the needles going very often in this movie. Once, you definitely do.
Yeah, but that was also an addition in the, I think it was the Blu-ray or Criterion version. If that looked surprising to you and unfamiliar, and it did to me because I saw the movie many times, so the version that I was watching must have been the American theatrical release. There's two shots in this version that they cut out to get a straight R rating, and one is the very graphic shot of Renton shooting up where you see the needle plunge into his vein and blood go into the syringe and he pushes it down. That was on the original American release. And the other shot is during the sex scene with him and Kelly MacDonald, where she's naked and she's straddling him.
Riding hard.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. She's having an orgasm. That scene was, or that shot, I should say, is not in the original theatrical American version. But in that version, you can understand what they're saying in the first 20 minutes of the film. So it has that going for it.
I wish they'd done more than just the first 20 minutes. Because I guess that would acclimatize you the way they talk. But if they start talking the other way, then you'd be lost all over again.
Have you ever read the book?
No.
I've read the book. And
this is your movie. I don't know this one nearly.
Yeah, it's true. I was a huge fan. Oh, I'm still a huge fan. I liked it enough that it inspired me to read the book. I would compare reading Trainspotting to the same experience I had reading Clockwork Orange, where you read the first chapter, and then you kind of get a fluency, and then you have to go back and read it again because the slang is so thick that you honestly have no idea what they're saying.
The Cockney and Clockwork Orange. Yeah, you have to just read it. And also the NADSAT that they invent. The NADSAT language they invent, too, would be a problem.
Are you talking about in Clockwork Orange?
Clockwork Orange, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And the difference, of course, is that in Trainspotting, that language exists. Like, there are people in the world who are fluent in that language, which is not true for Clockwork Orange. The touch works the same way it works in Clockwork Orange, where Anthony Burgess, right? His intention was to make them seem very much like others, the way that to a certain generation, the youth are always these foreigners. You're never going to understand them. They always are set so much apart. The working class youth have their own language. And the same works for Trainspotting. You have this working class youth. They have their own language and culture. They don't want to be a part of our culture. They don't want us to understand them. That's kind of what makes it work. But it certainly makes the book and the movie far more challenging.
And they don't really want to be saved from doing drugs, too, which, as we said, is an unusual touch in a movie like this.
Yeah, it's really clear the clean life has nothing to offer these guys. They would sooner die of an overdose in their 20s than die slowly of complacency, like those pensioners they're stealing the TV from.
Hmm, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that, so you say that right now.
Yeah, and they really acknowledge the appeal of diving headfirst into the whole lifestyle.
Maybe the most famous scene of the whole movie is diving headfirst into a toilet.
A great metaphor, too, for what his life has become, the worst toilet in Scotland.
And then when he goes back to his room, for some reason he's completely soaked, even though it's supposed to just be this metaphor that he went into the toilet. Why he's completely soaked, I don't know.
That's one of the cute, part of the gag, element. I guess. I mean, this movie's so fun. You cannot exaggerate, even though talking about it probably could sound so easily like a bleak film, because so many terrible things happen. Part of the thing that makes it so fun are these great fantasy sequences, like when he dives at first into the room. Repulsive toilet.
To get the suppositories, and as I said to you, I've not seen the movie enough to really remember what his whole goal was. I knew about the scene, but forgot why he was doing it, and I said, he's going to put those back in his ass after they've been in the toilet.
They have heroin in them.
Supposedly he did.
Yeah.
You know, the thing is, I said in the nutshell, though, about how don't judge people that do this because we're all doing our own version of an addictive substance. But I don't think that my addictive substance would have me diving into toilets or even touching toilets. Well, then you get to touch a toilet sometimes and you wash your hand quickly, but not the toilet they show in this movie. Good God.
Yeah, as much as I need my coffee in the morning, I would put up with a caffeine withdrawal rather than even use that bathroom, let alone touch anything. But I think the main difference is that our addictions are society-sanctioned addictions.
Well, they also don't overtake your entire brain. I mean, I guess sugar actually does, but it doesn't make you crazy the way that these people do. They have to have this to survive. Whenever you see, and this movie shows the same scene we've seen in other heroin movies, Nick Nolte did a scene kind of like that in The Good Thief in the early 2000s. Neil Jordan may have directed that. But anyway, he has the whole, like, I guess, sweat through the sheets kind of deal.
He handcuffs himself to the bed.
Right. And any movie that's ever had heroin probably has eventually had, except in Pulp Fiction. There's a movie we haven't mentioned that this has to have been influenced by. The energy, the soundtrack, no score. There's no composer in this movie, just like in Pulp Fiction. It's all previously recorded hits and a lot of great songs.
And it had a best-selling soundtrack as well. Lust for Life and Born Slippy both were huge hits coming out of this movie.
And takes low lives and makes them fun and interesting. When we did Pulp Fiction, I said to you that the Heroes and Villains nomination list doesn't make clear if you're a hero or a villain nominee. And Jules and Vincent are on there. I thought, I guess they're villains, but in their own movie, are they villains? Because the movie is made fun. Tarantino's so great at that. He makes lowlifes interesting, fun, entertaining. And of course, that movie inspired so many movies in the 90s. It had to have inspired this one, too.
So here's the question. Is Mark Renton a hero or a villain?
Well, at the end, he does admit he's a bad person when he takes the money of his friends. And he also, illegal money, but then I'm not going to judge that too harshly, but it is not legal money. So admitting he's a bad person makes him harder to side with. He also proves there's no honor among druggies because he's just walking away with their money, although one of them's not a druggie, and that would be Begbie. But having built it up that way, yeah, I guess it's like Alex in A Clockwork Orange.
Yes, very
He's the hero of his own story.
Yeah.
But he's not a good guy. He's a bad guy.
So I have this theory that because he says over and over in the film, his friends are not just idiots, they're psychos. They're bad people, particularly Begbie and Sick Boy. They keep ruining Renton's life. He tries to go straight, he tries to get his act together, and they come and they just shit all over it. And he says over and over, what am I supposed to do? They're my mates. He really acts like that was out of his hands and he has no control over it. So I think part of him stealing the money, which is not that much money, it's only 16,000 pounds. To those people, it's a lot of money, but it's hardly fuck you money. It's hardly, oh, I can retire now money, start a new life. Even in the late 80s, even with the exchange. But it was enough money to completely screw his friends over and to burn that bridge. In order for him to rescue himself and save himself from the clutch of his shitty friends, with the exception of Spud, who's obviously sweet.
But who just sees kind of, him leaving with it, too, and doesn't say anything.
Oh, God, the look on his face.
It's a great moment for him.
But he has to burn that bridge. Betrayal's the only way for him to escape that life. So it's not just that he gets the money. It's really that he forces himself to go far enough away he can never go back. Although, there's a sequel, so he obviously goes back.
I wonder what's going to happen, too, because it looks like most of the actors are in it. The ones who survived, anyway, are in it. I guess it's going to be that Begbie, at the very least, if not all three of them, are going after him to get their money back. The movie is called Trainspotting, but this is something that, of course, everyone's noticed, or most people do at least. No one actually spots any trains in the movie. I guess that's a heroin user reference, and supposedly they would get it.
No. In the book, there's a scene where they're in a train station being derelict youth. There's an old man there asking if they're there train spotting. It's because apparently there's people in Scotland with nothing better to do who make a habit of counting trains or keeping track of the number of trains, the numbers on the trains, I should say, that pass through one station or another. And it's this kind of strange, obsessive, almost collecting hobby, like bird watching, but train spotting. So it is a real thing, train spotting, and they explain it in the book, but just never bothered including that scene in the movie. But the book had been a huge hit. It was also a play, and Ewan Bremner played Renton. So the guy who played Spud played Renton in the play, and it was already hit and a phenomenon, so they kept the name. And it was just a cheeky reference that they're like, we don't need to explain this to you, which was kind of a 90s thing,
too. And I mentioned Tarantino a few minutes ago, and almost everybody who's made, at least the early ones, Dogs and Pulp Fiction, didn't explain what those meant, especially those were Dogs. Pulp Fiction was based on those Pulp Fiction books that Vincent is reading, for one thing, when he dies in the toilet. Well, this movie, speaking of toilets, wallows in grossness. The toilet scene, of course, where he dives in there. The shit-stained sheets, that was unnecessary. One of those things where you knew where it was going, you think, come on, that would not happen. But they got to go for the gross-out, I guess. And then some of the heroin scenes are just pretty disgusting. The baby is pretty freaky when you see it laying there dead. And then when they have it in his fantasy, of course, it's pretty freaky. It's not really gross, but it's also unusual. But you mentioned on Bad Santa a few weeks ago that
there's something so subversive about filth. About a character who's okay living in filth like that. Either diving in a toilet or lying on one of those filthy mattresses in their heroin dens. The way they live, even when he moves to London, he has what appears to be a decent job. He still lives in what looks like a crack den.
Well, then his friends make it a lot worse when they live there. Begbie throws out cigarettes, just has this big pile that no one's ever picking up. I like that touch. I'm not surprised he wouldn't pick them up and put them in the trash, but neither does Renton, neither does anybody else. There's a whole mountain of them out there. But then when Sick Boy comes, the whole place is just trashed. Nice touch, though, that when he kicks them out or when they're gone, I forget how that worked out, Renton is cleaning up after them. So it suggests that he's got a normal life out of him if he just stay off the drugs. And more importantly, like you just said, stay away from them. But he can't seem to do either of those things. I don't think he likes his friends. The way they portray in the movie, at least, he doesn't actually enjoy them. Maybe they did enjoy each other 5, 10, 20 years ago. But they don't seem to like each other much. And the sequences that we see,
they probably are only friends because they're junkies. With the exception of Begbie, and who knows how they met him, because not only is he not a heroin user, but he seems like he's got 10 years on them.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. This movie is full of references to other things. It's one of the more influential and also influenced movies we've covered in a while. There's a lot of references to the Beatles, including the opening running sequence when he's delivering that monologue that you did in the coffee sponsor. The volcano bar is designed like Clockwork Orange's Corova Milk Bar, including some of the writing on the wall, which looks exactly the same. And Boyle makes references to many other films. Look at the IMDb for that, because they'll explain it better than I can, and there's a lot of them as well.
He apparently got the cast to watch Clockwork Orange as research. The Hustler was another one.
I was surprised when I read that. The Hustler,
I
really.
I guess because it's about lowlifes and criminals.
Not seedy, though, and certainly not desperate. He's not that desperate, I wouldn't say, in the whole picture. No. Maybe Sarah is to a degree.
Yeah, that's true. She's a drunk. The Hustler seemed like a surprising choice, but Clockwork Orange, also an incredibly British film, mm-hmm. and about working class England.
And rebelling for no good reason other than because they can and they want to. One more thing about The Hustler, I gotta say, maybe Boyle said to them, watch it just because it's great. And he'd be right. Okay, well, Ewan McGregor, we know him as Obi-Wan Kenobi, I guess, first and foremost. Well, for just casual movie fans, maybe. We watched I Love You, Philip Morris, not long ago when we bought Bad Santa. We bought them together. And he's going to be in Fargo next year, 2017, the third season. They didn't have a season in 2016, and it looks like he's playing two characters. I'm presuming that's twins.
Oh, that makes me so happy. I love Ewan McGregor.
And he's got so many other film roles. He's one of those guys you could rattle off his roles for 10 minutes. Moulin Rouge. Who would have thought in this picture, and I don't remember Shallow Grave that well, but I'm assuming it's not a romantic kind of movie, and here he's a singing romantic lead only a few years after this movie, 5 years later, in fact. He got way into the role in Trainspotting, but he didn't actually try heroin, which I think was probably wise.
He considered it. He also lost about 30 pounds. 2 stone, as they say. So he could look like that scrawny, underfed kid.
And it worked. Johnny Lee Miller, who played Sick Boy, was in Hackers before that with Angelina Jolie, and I think he was one of the ones that she's married. Isn't she been married to
about three or four people? Yeah, he was her first husband.
Okay, right. He later played Holmes. Like I said, he's actually recently played Holmes on Elementary, and he's done a lot of TV, but not really that much beyond Hackers, Trainspotting, and Elementary. We've never covered Sean Connery until now, because early on especially, Sick Boy is doing impersonations of him, and I guess that's just one of those things where they heard Johnny Lee Miller doing impersonations of Connery and said, let's throw that in there. Or is that in the book? Maybe it is. I don't know.
I can't remember that detail, but it is a pretty funny touch, his obsession with Sean Connery.
He does sound like him.
But he also sounds like just a drunk asshole at a party talking about that thing he's obsessed with that nobody else gives a shit about.
Right, yeah.
He's a very muscular actor. What are you talking about?
Monopenner. Ewan Bremner, who's ugly as shite. Maybe they make him look worse than he really does look, but he's got that rat face. He's been in a lot of important and good movies, though. Snatch. Definitely an influence from this movie, and Black Hawk Down. There's a cast list, by the way, Black Hawk Down. You think about Harry Potter and that whole series. Think about Lord of the Rings, made around, all of them are made in 2001. The first movies in those series, at least Black Hawk Down was a one-off. There's a movie that had a ton of actors, including Ewan McGregor, who were nobodies at the time. I believe I saw Tom Hardy's name on that cast list recently. There are a ton of actors who are nobodies then who are big players now, and Bremner's not a big player, but there he was in that film. Kevin McKidd plays Tommy, the one who doesn't do drugs, along with Begbie, I guess, until he just decides to do them, and he's the only one of these guys who ends up dead. And I suppose that's a deliberate touch.
The film got a lot of criticism, specifically from Bob Dole, for what people call glamorizing heroin use, but I strongly disagree. I don't think there's anything to glamorize heroin. I know it admits that there's something fun about heroin, but that should be obvious to anybody, and unless you stop watching after the first 10 minutes, there's a ton of examples of how it ruins your life. And of course, the most dramatic example that's almost overkill is Tommy, who finally gives in and decides to try heroin, and within a year he's dead on a filthy mattress from toxoplasmosis.
Oh, I don't remember how to say.
Complicated by HIV. He had AIDS, and he basically died of AIDS till his neighbors smelt him and his rotting corpse. Just the worst thing you could imagine happened to this previously healthy, strapping, seemingly hopeful young man.
And as I recall, unless I was asleep, he died off screen.
Yes.
So a lot of things happen off screen, including most of the heroin injection. And you know, you don't need to see that needle go in. We see it in Requiem for a Dream. Great drug movie. You don't really need to see that needle go in, I guess, to get the gist. But then that movie's going for the ultimate hardcore, this is what this really is about. That movie is hard to watch. It's one of those that you don't watch often.
It's a great example of how most movies that deal with addiction are humorless and dour as hell. There's so little pleasure in it. Yeah. Whereas Trainspotting, not really necessarily pleasure in the drugs, which they do show, but just there's so much pleasure in watching the movie. It's such a fun movie.
And I can't recall seeing a movie where the characters are druggies because it's something to do. The movie basically says that, but that was the thing I got from it was, we're doing this because it's something to do. Most movies don't go down that road at all.
Yeah, and that the whole lifestyle was something that they were knowingly, openly choosing. That great scene that I think really sums up the theme of the film when Tommy, well, he's still sober. Actually, all of them are sober at the time, but Tommy hasn't tried heroin yet. Tries to get them all to go for a hike, which is just such a ridiculous thing to insinuate that these four young men should go on a nature walk.
Oh, people do that. Why not?
No, lots of people do that. But does Renton and Spud and Begbie go on a nature walk?
They are
no.
on train tracks.
Sick Boy, not Begbie.
They're on train tracks.
Yeah, they are on train tracks. Yeah. But at this point, Renton has probably the second most famous monologue in the film where he's like, being Scottish is shite.
Right.
And he talks about how miserable it is being Scottish and how there is no hope. He's just so fucking miserable. And then I think the scene wraps up with him in a voiceover saying, we immediately made the conscious decision to start doing heroin again.
Yep. I like the touch. Maybe it's in the book, but it's not in the movie, where they're not saying, this is Thatcher's fault, because that would be a cheap shot. They may be right. I don't think it's a cheap shot to blame her or blame Reagan in America.
Like, I think Scotland...
It would be too easy to do that, though, too.
Scotland was the victim of England for a long time.
Including
in
Braveheart.
Before Thatcher got her hands on Scotland, they were getting fucked by England. So, yeah, there's a lot to blame. It's not just Thatcher.
Kelly MacDonald plays the young girl, Diane. She was supposed to be 15. I read 14, but I'm saying 15. She was actually 19 when they shot her. That was part of Danny Boyle's subversive thing to go with somebody who wasn't actually a minor. And she does have the sex scene with McGregor, so she's got to be naked. I like her a lot in Gosford Park and Finding Neverland. Very small role in that, where she plays Peter Pan. Been in a ton of other movies, too, beyond that.
Are you forgetting?
What, the main voice in Brave?
No, well, there's that. Yeah, there's absolutely that, too. But my favorite Kelly MacDonald role is Norma Jean or something in No Country for Old Men. I can't remember her character's name.
Oh, yeah, Carla Jean.
Carla Jean, course, yeah. She's amazing in that movie. Like, she's a really good actress.
You know, I forgot because she isn't playing English or Scottish, I guess. That's what made me forget
I didn't recognize her.
When I saw the movie, I didn't recognize her either. And I forgot she was in until you say right now. There you go. Good on her that I even forgot she was in the film. Last actor I want to mention is Peter Mullan or Mullen, but it's M-U-L-L-A-N. He's been in a ton of things, including Braveheart. And a movie we're going to cover in 7 days, Children of Men, with a fairly major role, especially compared to this one. He's the drug handler for them, the one who gets
Mother
the high.
Mother Superior.
Right, Mother Superior. Danny Boyle, this guy's got a diverse resume of pictures. It's pretty impressive. 28 Days Later, of course, the not zombie film, of course. Don't call them zombies. They're infected. But the zombie film. Slumdog Millionaire, the one that won a bunch of Oscars in 2008. And it was a pretty big hit, too. 127 Hours with James Franco. Whole different film there. The list of his goes on. It changes so much. Shallow Grave, I haven't seen in a long time. That was a dark movie about somebody dying. I forget what it's even about now. Life Less Ordinary, I just watched it on Netflix. Didn't hold up. I saw it before and liked it quite a bit, years and years and years ago. Saw it again not long after we saw this one and thought, it doesn't work so well. But Ewan McGregor is in
it
with Cameron
well.
Diaz.
Maybe.
I think Cameron Diaz is part of the problem. She's kind of unlikable.
Oh, really? I was going to say maybe the only reason you ever liked it is because she was so hot back then or something.
I was never a huge fan of hers.
Oh.
Oh, and the reason, if people have never heard the story before, why McGregor and Boyle only worked together 3 times, even though the first 3 movies that Boyle made starred him, is because when Boyle didn't cast him in The Beach, instead he went with Leonardo DiCaprio. And who could really blame anybody for casting DiCaprio in 2000, coming off of Titanic? DiCaprio only made 1 or 2 other movies after Titanic before that. He was in a small cameo on Celebrity, the Woody Allen movie, and maybe that's it. So then when you can get him in your movie... Sorry, Ewan, you're a good actor and getting to be a pretty big name, but then again, he'd been in Star Wars by that point, but when they were casting, it probably hadn't come out. Anyway, the point is, if you can get Leo in your movie, how do you really hold it against him? But I guess Ewan did for all these years, and they must have mended fences because he's going to be the star of Trainspotting 2. The writer John Hodge is a former doctor, which is one of the reasons why he knows so much about drug addicts and drug users. He wrote those 5 movies for Boyle, and he also did The Program, which is currently on TMN, the movie network here in Canada. That's about Lance Armstrong and his drug program. Yeah. And that was not bad. I'd never really heard much about it, so I thought this is pretty interesting the way it's laid out there.
Is it a scripted film or a documentary?
It's not a documentary. There's been a few documentaries about Armstrong, but this one is a drama with Ben Foster playing Armstrong. Oh. And he wrote that. He based it on Irvin Welsh's 1993 novel. Welsh plays Mikey. We see him a couple times in the movie, and he's the one that sets him up for the last big drug buy.
Oh my god, I never knew that. That's Irvin Welsh?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And he did write the sequel novel. We mentioned Andrew McDonald at the top of the podcast in the trivia. He was the producer. He's made 6 movies with Boyle, and he's also done Ex Machina, which we saw a couple years ago and loved it, of course. That's also on Netflix. If you haven't seen Ex Machina, check it out, and he will be the producer on Trainspotting 2. Most of the people we've talked about, apart from those who died or involved in that movie, died in the storyline, not in reality. I don't know if anybody in this cast or crew have died. Maybe they have. I don't know. The movie is 185-1, and we saw a fairly crappy print on Netflix. I mean, maybe we should just watch your DVD after all. But I thought maybe we'd see the Blu-ray, and I guess we didn't.
It's my guess that Netflix probably used the same print that the DVD used.
Well, then again, we've seen a lot of prints on Netflix that are great, and I suspect usually it is the Blu-ray. Same with Turner Classic Movies. I'm impressed when you see old movies and how often they look good. Mm. But not this time. The cinematographer, Brian Tafano, worked for nearly 50 years, and I guess he was probably the veteran on the set. And I just pictured that the cinematographer being the one who was trying to herd all these young people, these crazy people in this crazy movie together. It's probably him, because he'd already been working for a long time.
He pulled off some really cool shots, too, like some really creative stuff.
On no money. Mm-hmm. He shot Shiloh Grave for Boyle before that, and then Billy Elliot a few years later. The editor, that's Bev's thing, Masahiro Hirakubo. He cut Boyle's first four movies, but hasn't done anything in a long time. I didn't see if he was going to cut Trainspotting 2.
You got to give him credit, too, because the pacing of this film is just perfect. There is not a wasted frame in it. Although, probably the one criticism anybody could pay to this movie is that it doesn't really have a traditional plot. Now, the book didn't either. They just tried to kind of cobble together the best they could, but it's very episodic.
And the music is a touch you got to talk about, too. Scorsese Tarantino-esque, where they're using hits rather than a traditional score. And when you say the name Scorsese, you got to think about a guy who said when he won his Oscar for The Departed, it's the first movie ever done with a plot. Not a guy who did plot very often in his movies, or even Tarantino, I suppose. Well, maybe he did more so than Scorsese. But definitely this movie is homaging Scorsese-type films, too.
And he uses familiar songs. They convey emotions already, so there's like a shortcut right there to the audience to tell them how to feel. Also, the film's doubtlessly influenced by music videos. This was 1996. Music videos were high art at this point. It has that kind of pacing and kinetic energy. And I know Danny Boyle wasn't necessarily young when he made the film. He was about our age. He was 39. But it's a movie made with young actors for a young audience. And it was copying youth culture.
For a director, 39 is pretty young.
Yeah, you're right.
A lot of people making vital films in their 50s and 60s, and they're just now getting it. It's one of the unfortunate things about this kind of business. People always say it's for young men or these young people, but you really start to learn everything, and then you get too old really to make movies anymore, so you might as well be energetic and crazy at all ages you could possibly be. So yeah, when you're 39, 40, you maybe haven't really gotten yourself going yet.
And he's pushing 60 and still making incredibly energetic films.
Including Steve Jobs just last year that got nominations for Michael Fassbender and Kate Winslet. Not a great film.
Not his best.
And certainly not his kind of film. I forgot it was him that directed it. I was looking through his resume. I thought, oh, that's right. That was Boyle. He's got such a diverse resume that you can forget what kind of movies he made and the style and everything, because they do change. Zombie films versus guy stuck in a hole films versus Indian musicals.
He's a very brave director. I would say more than most brave directors, his experiments pay off. It's never perfect. There's things in Trainspotting that don't work. But overall, the movie's amazing. It's like lightning in a bottle. Like, most of the stuff he tries is incredible. And at the time, in 1996, it was so fresh and mind-bending.
Yep. The influence, I think we've covered so much of it already, or most of it anyway. Clockwork Orange, Pulp Fiction, other rebellious youth films. And also, I mentioned Snatch and Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, for that matter. Those two movies had to have been influenced by the indecipherable language. Now, that's Guy Ritchie and Matthew Vaughn, the director and producer combination who made those movies. And, of course, Brad Pitt's whole character in Snatch is deliberately indecipherable, where the characters literally say, "What did he just say?" I like Snatch. It was fun and it was funny. I wasn't a big fan of Lock, Stock. And I'm going to say this now because I haven't already. If I had to vote on Trainspotting, I wouldn't give it a thumbs down, but it would definitely be a very almost thumbs down. Because I couldn't understand what the hell they were saying, and because it does wallow maybe a little bit too much. I can't say I disliked it, but I can't say I liked it either. I didn't latch on to it.
So it bothers you on the level that you think it's exploitative or cheapens it?
I didn't latch on to it the way I wanted to, I suppose. I've seen it, I guess, 3 times now, and I've never really loved it. Just like I've never loved Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels the way so many other people do.
Huh.
I did like Snatch more. If we're going to talk about all three films, if I had to just pick one to keep on the shelf, it would be Snatch.
Really?
Maybe because that one is a little more self-aware of its ridiculousness and the whole Brad Pitt thing.
Okay, but of the language thing, how do you reconcile that with how you feel about Clockwork Orange? That's guilty of the same thing.
I don't think it is. I understand what they're saying more, and I've also seen that one so many times. Maybe it's like a horror film where you grow accustomed to the scares and you're not so scared anymore. You see Jaws enough times, you know the shark's coming, you're not so scared by it anymore.
No, we're talking about the language.
I know, so maybe because I've seen the movie so often, I know it's coming, I know what they're saying. So if I were to watch Trainspotting over and over again, maybe I'd get it more. And maybe you're not supposed to really get it. You know that Begbie's just monologuing. It doesn't really matter what he's saying because these guys are liking him but also afraid of him. So if he's saying something useful or something not useful, it doesn't really matter. But it also disconnects me a little bit from the experience.
When you can understand what they're saying, you discover that the script is phenomenal. That Choose Life monologue off the top, if you can't understand what he's saying, look it up. That's an incredible piece of writing. So imagine all of the writing we're missing because we can't understand what they're saying.
Right. Hodges' screenplay was nominated for the Adapted Screenplay Oscar in 1996. It's pretty impressive for a movie that was indie and would have been probably over the Academy's head. It had no chance of winning. And of course, it didn't win. Sling Blade won that year. But it was nominated for that one thing. It's the only list or award thing I have here at all. So that brings us to the end of the podcast. Last thoughts on Trainspotting, Bev?
Well, I still love this movie. I would highly recommend it to anyone. I was the perfect age when it came out. I do not have critical distance, but 20 years later, now that I'm probably more apt to relate to Renton's parents than Renton and his friends, I still think it's incredible. The energy's phenomenal, and it tells this common story in a really uncommon way without ever, to me, feeling exploitative. So I'd say if it's been a while since you've seen Trainspotting and you're worried if it holds up or not, revisit it. It was more than just a 90s phenomenon. It's an excellent film.
I acknowledge that I'm probably the one who's wrong in saying that I would give it a very guarded thumbs up. Because those are all good points. I think we made good points with the podcast about what makes the movie work. The energy, the vitality. The actors are pretty good, even though they're unintelligible. It doesn't make them bad actors, especially McGregor, of course. The direction's fine. The technical skills are pretty good for a movie that had no money. But I just didn't latch onto it. Sometimes you can't explain why you don't latch onto a movie, though, either.
Mm-hmm. There's so many great little imaginative touches in it that still seem unique 20 years later.
Well, it's pretty entertaining considering the brutal subject matter. And as we said already, not many movies that have this kind of subject matter, alcoholism, drug addiction, what have you, can be entertaining and fun. Not that funny. I don't think we laugh that much at it, but I guess it's not trying to be laugh-out-loud funny all the time, either. It's more silly funny or more situationally
amusing.
Funny. Amusing. And you know, we said there's no plot, but I guess the one thing you can compare it to is that at the beginning of the movie, they're running away, and it's a drug thing they're trying to do. And then at the end of the movie, it's a drug plot where he's not running away, he's walking away, but there is that loop. That's another thing about the movie. It's one of those vicious loop kind of things. Mm-hmm. It's over and over again, just like Clockwork Orange, where Alex is never going to change. I'm cured, all right.
But Renton does change.
I don't know if he's going
to. Well, we'll find out when the sequel comes out in January, won't we?
I think he's one of those people that'll do heroin and get off it again and do it and get off again. And obviously he survived, but probably shouldn't have because not only is he doing something that is not good for him, but I'm not going to judge him harsher than that. Like I said in my nutshell, let's not judge somebody for being addicted to something. We're all addicted to something probably, unless you're incredibly clean. But he's a bad guy and he knows it. Okay, enough of that. In Seven Sunrises on the Next 100 Project, we take a look at another gritty motion picture. We'll peek into the dystopian future. Is the future in movies ever not dystopian? Well, sometimes it isn't, I guess. And we'll review the criminally underseen, at the time at least, Children of Men, the coming attractions trivia for Children of Men. How many times has the director, Alfonso Cuarón, cast the same leading man and leading lady in his films? In other words, repeat performances. I don't mean necessarily the same two from one film in another film. I'm talking about the leading man, leading lady in another film.
So just actors in general, be they male or female?
Yes.
All right, so for the answer to that, please tune into next week's podcast on Children of Men. Please check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes, and while you're there, check out our entire roster of podcasts. We've covered 185-ish movies.
A little more now.
Including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 98 or 07 lists of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free, and while you're there, rate us, review us. It helps people find us. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
You know what? Let's go try heroin.
Forget choosing life.
No, let's just go watch some TV.
And cut.
Another addiction, television.